67 of Up and In the Baseball Prospectus podcast. My name is Kevin Goldstein. I'm in DeKalb, Illinois. His name is Jason Parks. He's in Brooklyn, New York, and he's about to say hello to the internet.
Okay, I am. Howdy, internet.
We got a great show for you, as always. We're going to go through your wacky emails. Then we're going to talk about baseball and how we kind of have races. All of a sudden, after promising you time and time again that September would be boring as hell, it's not so boring all of a sudden. And then, we've heard from a lot of you that you want us to talk more about prospects. And every time we talk about prospects and we end a segment, Jason goes, man, I love talking about prospects.
I prefer it.
So we're going to talk about prospects. What we're doing is we're actually this is planned programming. So every episode, for the next six episodes, we are going to go through five systems. And I have a stopwatch here. We're not going to spend more than 5 minutes on any one system.
I'm going to go over.
And we're going, because the show is kind of backwards, we're going to go in reverse alphabetical order. So we will talk in depth about the Nationals, Blue Jays, Rangers, Rays, and Mariners systems.
Well, look at you, planning all this stuff. Good for you.
From there, since we actually have some excitement in the pennant race, we're going to talk about exciting pennant races, or playoff races, I guess. With our good friend Peter Abraham, who is the beat writer for the Red Sox for the Boston Globe. And he'll talk about what's going on with the Red Sox and panic in the streets of Boston and Boston Red Sox fans and covering it and what you look for. And how, whether you like it or not, you'd kind of hope for drama. You like good stories. There was a great tweet put out tonight by one of the writers for the Phillies about how hard it is to write meaningful sentences about a meaningless game. And it's an easier job if the games mean something. It's a heck of a lot more fun. No one wants to watch crappy games that mean nothing. And then from there, we'll do the goofy stuff. We'll talk about our musical guests. We'll talk about what we're drinking. For Pop Culture Mode, we're going to talk a little bit more about baseball. I want to talk about the Moneyball film that is not out yet and some of the effects it is having when it comes to discourse that are not a good thing. And then we'll wrap things up.
Okay.
It's time for your favorite part of the show, Jason, the housekeeping.
Yeah, I fucking love it.
If you want to email us, you can do so. And please do so. Your emails are always very, very good. And you did well this week, folks. Keep them coming. podcast@baseballprospectus.com. If you want to follow us on Twitter, you can do so. I am at Kevin_Goldstein. Jason is at Professor Parks. If you want to join the Facebook page, you go to Facebook and you look for the podcast. And there's like a Facebook page where you can do Facebook things. And you'll see the agenda for every show before it comes out. And a quick housekeeping note, this Saturday, today is Tuesday, 9/20, Saturday, September 24th, once again, I will be doing improv comedy.
Well, look at you.
I don't do improv. I just tell baseball stories, and the fine improv people at putting thank you, then bring the funny. And it is Saturday night. It is 10:30. It's at the American Theater Company, which is at night.
Is it really funny, though?
They were very funny last time. It was actually a blast.
Improv to me isn't usually funny.
I've been to bad improv. I have, and these guys were funny. I laughed.
I believe you.
And American Theater Company, 1909 West Byron on the north side, 10:30 p.m., $10, free beer. I tell baseball stories. They make you laugh. It's about the best $10 you'll spend all year. And come see us, and come say hi after the show. It's a good time. You ready for the email, Jason?
Yes.
Our first email is from Matt in Brooklyn, who's become kind of our official emailer of existential questions. And Matt says, and I want you to think about this, Jason. How many wins do you think a team where everyone has a 50 tool for everything would get? Would this be a team of replacement players who would win exactly 81 games? Are most players somewhere near this, and the lack of any sort of star doom them to a 100-loss season? Thanks, Matt from Brooklyn. So every player, catcher, first, second, third, short, left, center, right, is 50 hit, 50 power, 50 speed, 50 field, 50 throw, Jason.
So it's a team full of five-tool players?
It's a team filled with guys who are 50s across the board.
I think that the pitching would be average, but I think that the hitting would be very good.
Let's just say for the sake of this argument, the pitching is league average.
Okay.
How does this team do in the standings?
I mean, I think that the offense would be really, really good. I don't. Most players in baseball, even the best players in baseball, I mean, most of them can't boast to having, you know, five to being actually five tool talents, you know.
But they're just 50 tools. Let's.
Okay, well, a 50 tool guy is going to hit about, you know, 270.
270 with, let's just.
15 home runs. 10 to 15 home runs.
15 home runs, 15 stolen bases.
Okay, I mean.
But everybody across the board. I think the biggest strength of this team is the fact that there's no holes in the lineup. There's no easy innings. There's no, 7-8-9 or 6-7-8 if they're a National League team.
Right, but you also don't have a game one or two starter.
But you also don't have a star in your middle of your lineup.
You do not.
And so I actually bounced this one off of a scout, and he thought they'd win more than 81. I think that they
would win more than 81.
I think they'd win closer to 90, but not a ton. But the thing is, again, take that player that we just made up, 270, 15 to 18 home runs, 15 to 18 stolen bases, and go look at a lineup of a playoff team, Tigers, Red Sox, Phillies, Diamondbacks, and tell me how many players you'd replace that they have now that you'd replace with that guy.
It's probably most of the Diamondbacks.
Most of the Diamondbacks. But for a lot of teams, it's not even half.
No.
And again, and the increase you get from whatever they have to that 50 guy across the board is not as big as the decrease you get from replacing, say, Miguel Cabrera with that guy.
No, of course. I mean, you're going to need star power. Just being 50s across the board, you don't have that guy in the middle of the lineup. But then again, you know, on the other side of the ball, you don't have a guy who's going to come in the eighth and ninth and be able to shut a team down and miss a lot of bats, because you have a guy who's going to have a 50 fastball, right?
Well, we're just doing the lineup. Just say league average pitching.
Okay. Well, I think that's a little different. I mean, league average pitching would balance out with some being very poor and some being very good. If they're all 50, then that changes the way you would look at this, right?
Probably.
Because you wouldn't have anybody who could rear back and blow somebody away.
Yeah, you wouldn't.
Technically speaking,
you wouldn't have a good closer.
Right, and you'd have a pretty good middle of the pen. You'd have a pretty weak end of the pen.
Yeah. You'd have a good end of the rotation.
You'd have a great end of the rotation. Right. I don't know. I mean, that's a really interesting question, because part of me thinks, like, having five-tool players on offense, having guys that can run, who can make some contact, who can hit for some power, that's an offense that's going to be able to manufacture runs.
And I think it's actually worth more because the lineup, again, has no holes in it.
Right. I mean, I would think that it's more than 81 wins. But then again, you can't say, well, this team's going to be awesome. Because there's enough holes just being average.
And no star power.
The lack of star power is a hole.
I'm going to go with 87.13 wins.
I like that number. I'd go a little lower.
Jason says 87.04. Our next email is from Steven. Steven's in Canada. And Steven says, "Dear Sarge and Professor, I need this. I'm a fairly new listener, but I've done a lot of listening back, listening to all the wisdom and humor the best podcast on the web can bestow upon me. Well, I'm glad you listen to our show as well. Is there any chance we can interest you a job in using your dulcet tones north of the 49th parallel?" Well, Blue Jays, Canadians don't like us generally, Stephen. It's important to note that.
Not really.
On to my question. You talk about going to minor league games, sitting behind home plate with a stopwatch, taking notes. Can you achieve the same sort of thing at, say, a Northern League independent game? Would there be scouts there to talk to and learn from? I live very far from every minor league affiliate out there, just above Minnesota, and the Winnipeg Goldeneyes are the only team with an actual driving distance of my location. Thanks, love the podcast. Keep it up, Steven. No, you'd actually, you know, no. I'm sorry. Indie League ball is cool, but unless there's a reason, like unless someone got a phone call and said, hey, there's some dude at Winnipeg with a 1.1 ERA striking out 15 per nine, go look at him. Unless somebody gets that call and that guy exists, there's probably not going to be a scout there.
Right. I mean, you could still achieve the objective of going to a game, sitting behind home plate, taking notes and using a stopwatch. But
there's no one to glean from.
You're probably not going to be able to extract much.
Yeah, you need someone to glean from. Going to games and finding someone you know is the greatest moment in the world. When you get to your game, you start walking down the aisle and you're looking behind the plate and you go, no. Oh, I know him. I can go sit there. And then you know you're going to have a much better time. And Indie League games just are not heavily scouted unless someone's blowing up. And it has to be someone with Winnipeg, because if someone with another team's blowing up, the scouts are going to wait till that player is somewhere other than Winnipeg to go see them.
Right.
They're not going to travel over to Winnipeg for that. So all I can recommend, Steven, really is to move.
Yeah, I think you have to move.
Yeah, time to come to the States and enjoy a country that does not have first world healthcare systems. Our next email comes from Nick. Nick says, hi, Kevin. Jason, you're cool. This isn't for you.
God, I wish every question started off like that.
Kevin, it sounds like you would have Tampa sell off prospects at the deadline anytime there were the 8.5 games of a playoff spot.
You're reading it with tone. There may not be tone implied. You're reading it
with tone. I read every email with tone. It's my job to bring the emails to life. Shouldn't the Rays value their farm system more than maybe any other team? And why would they expect Jennings to throw up a near 900 ops? Everything pointed to them not contending on July 31st. Jason was dead on when he leveled the revisionist history accusation. I'm not sure how you can write this in the middle of a September when no one was saying it then. Well, Nick,
go fuck yourself. Love Kevin.
I mean, it was 8.5, but my point was, what if Desmond Jennings was up in May? Then what would it have looked like? What if someone other than Annie Sonnenstein was making those four starts? Then what would it have looked like? Maybe it wouldn't have been 8.5. And maybe they would have done it. And we have plenty of evidence, including years when they were in it, like 2010, and years when they went to the World Series when they didn't do anything. My point was really just that you have to capitalize on every opportunity you have if you're one of those quote-unquote, I don't like the term, but I'll use it, small market teams. If you're one of those teams that, and especially one of the American League East, where it's not going to come every year, you need to capitalize. You can't keep going on the future. And Nick goes on, second thing, put on your thinking cap, Jason. Say two cars are driving parallel to one another on a two-lane road. The one on the left needs to get around the one on the right to make a right turn. When fans get nervous over a certain prospect playing the same position as an established big league star on their own team, how early are they jumping the gun on worrying about making that turn? 500 yards? 3 miles? 20? Keep up the great work, guys. Nick, the answer is 200. You get this all the time where let's talk about the Rangers real quick, Jason.
Okay.
Jurickson Profar.
Yep.
Pretty damn good shortstop prospect.
He's one of the best position prospects in baseball.
And people go, well, what about Andrus? They're already worked up over it, even though Jurickson Profar is a child who just finished a year in the Sally League. They get worked up over it. And my answer is you get worried about it at the very last second. It is a last second swerve. You leave that guy where he is until you are forced to make some sort of decision about it.
Right. I mean, and with the Rangers, there's a couple of reasons to anticipate a guy like Profar's arrival. One, you know, Kinsler is having a fantastic season, but is he a guy that you extend beyond the end of his contract now? Andrus is a guy who's represented by Boris. You know, he's kind of built for a big stage, and if Texas can provide that, that's great. If not, you could see him testing the free agent market. Again, this is down the line. This is something that you don't worry about now, you worry about in 3 years.
Right.
Or when it presents itself.
You worry about when it presents itself. I know a lot of Reds fans are worked up right now because you got Devin Masaraco, who's pretty much ready. And then right below that, you have another really good, one of the better catching prospects in baseball, in Yasmani Grandal. And you know what? What a great problem to have.
It's a fantastic
I mean, that's the thing. It's not a problem. It's a wonderful thing because if the guy's not going to play for you, he's an asset. And an asset you can use to get someone who will play for you. Teams generally laugh at the people who wonder and question and worry about prospects coming up that are blocked. It is a to have too many players anywhere is a fantastic thing, and it never turns out that way. I mean, think about that time when the Rangers had all those catchers, and none of those guys catch for them anymore. So many things change between a guy seemingly blocking someone and you being actually getting to the tipping point of needing to make a decision. So you don't make that decision until you get to the tipping point. So I would say fans are generally 200 miles and teams are generally swerving at the last minute.
I can see that. It's a good way of looking at
it. I'll go with swerve. Our next email is also from a Nick. And Nick says, Kevin and Jason, I have to thank you again for your amazing podcast. Since I was running at least 5 miles a day this summer, I burned through 3 to 4 back episodes a week, and I'm now a .9er, but that's not why I'm emailing you. I had been planning for a while to buy the Carter 4.
That's a fantastic record, by the way.
When it came out on iTunes. When it came out, I had 1 summer's worth of podcasts in my mind, and I bought Excellent Italian Greyhound instead. Thank you, Nick. Well, Nick, I'm glad you bought the most recent Shellac record. But Jason is all over the Carter 4 and would like you to buy that as well. Jason.
Yeah, I like Lil Wayne a lot. I always have.
And his new record is good?
Yeah, it's good. It's you know, I like some of the other stuff a little bit better, but I mean, this has Bun B, he's one of my favorite Texas rappers, on it. It's good. Wayne's always good. He's really sharp. I like him.
Next email is from Tim, and Tim says, Kevin and Jason, great show. Let's get out of the way. I'm not a .9er, but it's not out of want. I just don't have the time. Well, then you don't have the want.
I actually respect this guy, though.
While the distinction is prestigious, much like a PhD, CPA, or MD, I just don't think it outweighs the value of my social life. My question is this. Every time I hear Jason speak, I swear I keep hearing songs in my head by Texas bands like the extremely underrated late 80s rock band Junkyard, and even pop punkers like Bowling for Soup. What gives? I don't hear California rockers or Michigan rockers or even an occasional East Coast band. Did Jason escape one of these bands and start scouting baseball, or does every edgy artist type male coming out of Texas sound similar? Keep up the great work. Jason does have a little bit of an accent, Tim.
I do, and when I drink, it comes out a little bit more. Or when I'm around Texas brethren, it comes out a lot.
But Jason has this Texas accent that some people from Texas have, and you will find different accents from different people that are from the same area. There is kind of that yeehaw South accent, and there's kind of the Southern gentleman accent, which is actually quite charming.
It can be.
And Jason's kind of has the charming version of the Texas accent.
Indeed.
So you're aware of your accent.
It's not lost on me. I mean, I know where I'm from.
God knows we all know where you're from.
So I'm aware that I have a bit of an accent. You should see when, like, you know, Jason Cole and I get together and start tiffing them, because then it gets a little country.
The
country comes out.
I have a Midwestern accent, so. I mean,
you do?
I do. I say orange.
You say orange.
Right.
That's fucked up to me.
Our final email is from Harry in England. I bet Harry has an accent as well. And Harry says, hey, guys. I was reading a piece over at Baseball Prospectus the other day when various members of the team said what they would do if they were commissioner for a day. Most made fairly sensible minor rule changes, and Jason decided to establish the Warwick Davis little person mandate, where each team would be required to have two little people on the 25-man roster at all times.
I think it's a fantastic idea.
This is Jason taking everything seriously. Given Jason's slight obsession with Warwick Davis, I feel he needs to be made aware of a new BBC show coming later this year. Life's Too Short is a sitcom written and directed by Ricky Gervais and starring none other than Warwick Davis playing a fictionalized version of himself. I think it's safe to say this is going to be Jason's new favorite show when it airs, and it should be coming to HBO at some point as well. I just thought Jason needed to be made aware of this huge news, Harry in England. And to be note, he spelled favorite with that extra U that I dig.
I'm pretty ahead, I would say, of the Warwick Davis curve. I'm aware of the show, you know. I appreciate the letting me know.
Whoa, wait.
I'm in the loop big time.
This is actually true?
Yeah, oh yeah.
I thought that you made that up.
No, this is real. two of my favorite people on the planet are getting together and doing a mockumentary or whatever. So
I love Ricky.
I'm quite happy
I'm
with
a
it.
huge Ricky Gervais fan.
Oh, he's fantastic.
So there's going to be an actual show called Life's Too Short with Ricky Gervais writing a fictionalized version of Warwick Davis.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
We got to find some way to get these people on the podcast.
Man, that'd be awesome. I'd love to get Davis on. I got a lot of things to talk to him about.
Do you know some shit about him?
I know a lot of things about him, yeah. I don't know any secrets, or I may only know one secret, but it's not like the stuff I know about Keaton. That's legit.
On the thought of secrets about Michael Keaton, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk some baseball. We'll talk a lot about baseball, especially a lot about prospects. Then we'll have our special guest, Pete Abraham of the Boston Globe, and then we'll do the goofy stuff. So stick around, folks. Welcome back. Time to talk about baseball, Jason.
Alrighty.
We have races, kind of, sort of, kind of. Here's the thing. It's Tuesday night, folks. It's Tuesday night. It's 8:45 p.m. Central Time. And, you know, we went into the night with coming off the weird, I say weird doubleheader between Baltimore and Boston. In reality, it was horrible. It's just they're playing the worst baseball in the world. It's unbelievable. If you could listen to the show live, and you flip to the AAA championship game that's on TV right now, you'd be watching a better brand of baseball than what they're throwing out at the Fenway Park right now. But anyway, you know, after they split that, there was just still just two games between the Red Sox and the Rays, and two games on Monday or after on Tuesday, September 20th. That's still a mountain, folks. And right now, it looks like the Red Sox and the Orioles are tight, but Wade Davis shit the bed in New York, and the Yankees look like they're going to beat the Rays, and so they can't gain ground. And all of a sudden, it's 2 with one less game to go, and the calendar is as big an enemy as whoever's ahead of you at this point. Meanwhile, speaking of shit in the bed, the Braves have been doing that of late, with their bullpen not doing so well, and nobody hitting all of a sudden. But it looks like they're going to win tonight. They have a big lead late over the Marlins. And if these just stand pat and you lose a day, that's a huge thing. So do we have races, or are we just trying to get excited about something?
I mean, part of it's the hysteria is manufactured, of course. But, I mean, it's a closer race than it was earlier in the year. I mean, we have something. It may not end up being a true race, but, I mean, there's something. It's, you know, we don't have a conclusion yet. I think that's what it is. We don't have a conclusion.
But we still have a likely conclusion, and it's the same as what it was.
We have a likely conclusion. We don't have a conclusion. We have a conclusion in a lot of other races.
The thing that's really striking me, though, in watching some of these teams play, is that we're going to have some really crappy baseball in the playoffs. Like bad players playing, bad players starting game twos and game threes. It's going to be...
Yes. It could be ugly.
It's going to be really strange. And I think the American League is going to be especially fun where, you know, whoever you think is going to make the American League playoffs, let's just assume it's what it is. The Yankees, the Red Sox, the Tigers, and the Rangers. Matchup, and obviously we don't know who's going to play who because there's still some possible standing switching. Match up any of those teams. Make any two of those teams and pick a five-game series, and every one of them you'd go, I don't know who's going to win.
Yeah.
There's no favorite here.
No, I don't think so.
So, I mean, I just don't. I don't think anything's going to change. But Jason, people want to talk more about prospects.
Good. It's what we know more about.
And so, like I said, what we're going to do, beginning with this show, and then for the next five shows, which will get us through the playoffs, is we're going to talk about five organizations a show, because 6 times 5 equals 30, Jason.
Okay. Thank you.
And what we're going to do is we're going to go in reverse order alphabetically, and we're going to begin our talk, our prospect breakdown. We need theme music or something with the Washington Nationals. Now, the Nationals have been for a while kind of an organization where it's like, well, Strasburg's going to be awesome and Harper's going to be awesome and we're done talking. But I think that changed this year. I think you saw some good things happen in the national system and beyond just what was a really great draft. They had some good things happen in their existing minor league system. And you're seeing some of those things now. I think Brad Peacock's going to be a pretty good big league starter. But that draft is going to really help the system. You got another potential big league starter or two even with Alex Meyer and Matt Perk if he can stay healthy. You added a heck of a bat potentially in Anthony Rendon. Some athletic player in Goodwin. This team suddenly looks like not just a team that's going to get better because of Strasburg and Harper, but a team that's genuinely going to get better.
Right. I mean, well, they have money. They're willing to spend money.
And they have a really smart front office.
Right. So when you have that kind of combination, you know, judging by several teams coming up on this list, we're going to be talking about, you know, money. And how some teams have it and some teams don't. Some teams can, you know, throw a ton of money at high-ceiling amateur talent and, you know, live within the developmental ebbs and flows. You know, this year for the Nationals, some players took a step forward, you know. Guys like, in the coming years, you know, Cole could take a step back. Perk could take a step forward. Goodwin could develop, you know. Hood could develop. I mean, there's just a lot of things that could, you know, go forward or move backwards. And when you have a team that's willing to spend money on high ceiling talent, you know, you don't need them all to hit. Right. You know what I mean? You know, when you spend that sort of money on amateur talent, it's not going to all hit, you know, but when you have, I mean, just really like almost like no shit, no brainers, like Anthony Rendon, Bryce Harper. I mean, shit, that's talent. I mean, that's crazy. That's first division talent.
And you mentioned Cole. Keep an eye on Cole, folks. I think he's going to really be one to watch next year. His full season debut was this year, first round pick in 2010. 4.04 ERA might not catch your eye. And you might go, 108 strikeouts in 89 innings because he has legitimate misbat stuff.
Yeah, I mean,
He's got refinements to make, but he's got pro body, good stuff. I love that combination.
Yeah, I mean, that's the type of guy that I'm talking about. That, I mean, he could take a step forward next year. He could take a step back, and it'd still be a step forward developmentally speaking. I mean, he may have a bad year, but that's the kind of guy that you can wait a couple of years on because the ceiling is so high.
Mm-hmm.
And he's still so young. I mean, I really like their system. I think they've come a long way.
Well, I mean, let's talk about Harper. Obviously, Harper's the guy in the system that everyone
he's
wants
the guy in
to
every
talk
system.
About. Exactly. And Harper, you know, crushed the Sally League, got to Double-A, and you know, got touched up a little bit, hit 256, had a slugging under 400 before he got injured. So in 37 games, 256, just three home runs. What do you see for Bryce Harper in 2012?
I mean, he'll probably reach the major league level at some point, and he'll do well.
I think you'll see him in September at the very least.
Sure. I mean, he's going to play at the major league level in 2012.
And I think you're likely going to see him return to Harrisburg. I think he's going to kill it there.
I think he's going to fucking kill it.
I mean, he made some adjustments. Here's the thing about Harper. We can talk about, well, he only hit three home runs in 37 games. Now
That's
we only
a
hit,
small sample, man.
And he only hit 256. Let me give you another stat that really stood out for me. He struck out 26 times in 130 at-bats. That's fine. It's not like he was getting dominated. It's not like he was looking bad and getting crushed or anything like that.
Well, and he's 18.
And he's a child, an absolute child. He is as old as most 2011 high school draftees, and he's hitting 256 and slugging 395 in Double A.
Yeah, he's a superstar.
That's actually kind of sick.
It's ridiculous.
So Bryce Harper is going to be just fine. Another guy at Double A who gets a lot of extension because he's just so gosh darn weird is Derek Norris. Now, Derek Norris hit
You like him a lot.
Well, they'll think about it. Derek Norris hit 210, right?
Yeah.
That's awful. He hit 210. It's awful. He had a 367 on base percentage and a 446 slugging because in his 334 at bats, he drew 77 walks. And of his 70 hits, and he had just 70, he had 17 doubles, a triple, and 20 home runs. So 38 of his 70 hits went for extra bases. Now, again, he hit 210, but if you had a catcher who hit 275 with a 367 on base and a 446 slugging, you'd be really excited about him.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think he's got a good approach. No, I think he's got a good approach. I think he's got a lot of pop in his bat. I think he's got some miss in his swing. And he's going to have to shore up that hit tool. Or, you know, 210 and double A, is, I mean, that doesn't play outside of double A. He's not going to, he'll get swallowed up. So, I mean, I think he's a good prospect. I don't think he's a superstar prospect.
And
he brings a lot to the table, though. I mean, he does have a good approach, which is something that a lot of players just inherently struggle with. He's got pop, you know, and he knows how to catch.
I still think he's Mickey Tettleton.
Yeah, I mean, if he can do...
Which isn't a bad thing at all.
If he can do what he did in double A at the major league level, then yeah, maybe. But, I mean, we'll see.
So let's move on to our next team, the Toronto Blue Jays. Now, Blue Jays fans are...
hard.
Basically.
They should be. I think it's the number one system.
They're incredibly excited. Do you think it's the number one system?
Yeah, I do.
I think it's a little unbalanced to be a number one system.
I don't see anybody who can touch them, to be honest with you.
Going into the year, we talked a lot about the Rangers system and all those young arms that the Rangers have. And the Rangers still have a plethora of impressive young arms. I think Toronto has a more impressive group of young, projectable, high-ceiling young arms than the Rangers. I think they have the most impressive collection of these kind of pitchers than anyone in baseball right now.
I think that they're the number one system in baseball. I think that they're loaded. I mean, they have a lot of athletes. They, you know, they have, I mean, they're bottom heavy, you know, with a lot of the really high ceiling people. But mm-hmm. I mean, I love their aggressive approach in the Rule 4. I love the way they're treating Latin America right now. You know, getting guys like Cardona, Osuna, Becerra. I mean, they're really fucking cashing out. And these are high ceiling players, man. Big time.
Very high ceiling.
Arms.
These short season teams are loaded with names you have to know. Names
like Dickie Joe Thon. That motherfucker is going to be something.
He can back a ton of tools there. And I know he didn't put up good numbers in the Gulf Coast League. Don't worry about it. The tools. But team-wise, you talk about guys like Sanchez, Noah Syndergaard, who kind of came out of nowhere in the sense that, I mean, he was just kind of a big body projectable thing. And the projectable part showed up in less than a year. You know, when he went from a guy with, you know, average velocity, would flash a couple twos and threes there, to a guy thrown in the mid-90s and missing bats left and right. You're going to see a whole lot more of him. And Justin Nicolino, who was, mm-hmm. you know, probably the best pitcher in the Northwest League this year, out of nowhere. Another guy who just kind of, boom, I know I'm projectable, and here I am already. There's just so many good arms in this system. And then position player wise, it's not as good. I mean, there's some guys to really like. I've always been a huge Travis d'Arnaud fan, and I became a huge Jake Marisnyk fan this year. I don't know what there's to get excited about after that.
Carlos Perez is a pretty good player. He's going to have some up and down.
I think of disappointments in the Midwest League this year. That's one of my biggest. I was just.
Pretty young,
very still. Young, but boy, he just didn't do much at all. There was nothing about him that made you go, even he can be pretty good. He was surprisingly mediocre, and looked surprisingly mediocre. Not just forget about the numbers. I'm saying he looked nothing like what was promised in a lot of ways.
Well, he's a guy that has the talent, and you know, it's going to he's going to have to develop. Well, 2012 could be a year that he takes a step forward. If he does, the system just gets even sicker. I mean. Speaking of the Nationals and money, this is a team that also has a combination of front office intelligence, you know, the biggest scouting department in baseball.
By a truckload.
and an approach where, hey, you know, this is how we're going to win. We're going to throw a lot of money at high ceiling, high risk talent, and we're going to go for it.
I'm pretty sure they have two scouts just covering DeKalb.
It's unbelievable how
many scouts they have.
Right, and looking at the names of the players they have, looking at the names of the players they brought into from the Latin American market just this year, looking at the players they brought in from just the Rule 4 draft this year, I don't know if there's a team on paper that can match their talent.
I'm gonna throw a name at you now. This is a name that draws some of the most wide ranging thoughts on a guy you'll ever get. Anthony Goes.
Yeah, I mean. I'm a fan just because I love tools.
He sure has those.
He has too many of them. He's got a ton of tools.
16 home runs, 70 stolen bases, and the thing you can't really get a number on is a 70 plus maybe 80 arm in the outfield and a very good center fielder.
I think it's an 80, and there's, I mean, he could be a pitcher.
Oh, he was a pitcher. He was a great pitcher. There are plenty of people who wonder.
No, but I'm saying he could be a pitcher
and,
again.
At the same time, double A, 154 strikeouts in 137 games.
Yeah, he's loose with the swing. He's got a lot of miss in it. I've talked to a few sources that really question whether he's ever going to be able to pull the hit
tool
together.
That's a huge question for me.
If he does, he could be a star. I mean, he's got the tools to be, you know, a plus center fielder, you know, with a plus-plus arm.
And even if he doesn't, even if he can't ever pull that hit tool altogether, there's some chance he can turn into kind of Devon White, who was a great ball player and a guy that all the Blue Jays fans, I hope, should know and I hope loved because he was fantastic.
He could also turn into Greg Golson.
And he could also turn into Greg Golson, who was a guy that made Blue Jays fans don't know, but he was a first-round pick many, many years ago and still has among the best tools.
He's 70s and 80s across the board. It's ridiculous.
Never figured out how to hit. Never.
Texans.
I know you love your Texans.
Yes. But the Blue Jays are the number one system. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Okay,
again.
Okay. I think I have not ranked the systems. I don't know. I certainly think when I rank them that the Blue Jays will be at or near the top. I'm not ready to say they're the best system. I think they're going to be a candidate for when I actually do rankings.
Well, we'll just all wait to get your opinion.
That's what
it
matters.
Yeah, your opinion matters, and we'll just all wait.
That's how most people operate. Texas Rangers. This is a system I know you need to do some research on, Jason. You don't follow it closely. let me ask you a question, though, because I was thinking about this the other day. Between trades and some performances that were not up to expectations, is the Rangers system down? And if so, is it down significantly?
I think it's up significantly.
Wow. Not the answer I was expecting.
To be honest, I think it's actually up. And I'll tell you why. There's a couple of pieces in the draft that I think are going to sneak up next year. You know, the Matthews pick was obviously, I want to say, kind of safe. I mean, I spoke to Matthews about it. He thought he was like going to go in the third round. He was shocked that he was a first round guy. Obviously, you kind of like the gamer mentality there. But a guy that is turning heads is Will Lamb.
Yeah.
He's got a hell of an arm.
Will Lamb was a kid of we talk about these kind of guys. 6'6" lefties who get in the mid 90s do not exactly grow on trees. I still think he's a reliever in the end, though.
Well, yeah, that's possible. And here's my point, though. You see, like, there's some attrition. There's some stumbles. Angel Beltre, it looks like he's gonna fail to develop. Obviously, you lose a guy like Robbie Erlin from the system. Tanner Sheppers really hasn't stepped up to be Tanner Sheppers.
You lost Joe Weiland as well in those trades.
Right. And I mean, he was he's a good arm. He's a good mid-tier type of prospect. But what the Rangers did do is they added some really, really serious, serious Latin American firepower. Bringing in a guy like Leonis Martin, who's, you know, I don't know if you can pencil him in for 2012 immediately, but he's a hell of a
It's going to be somewhere prospect. Right around immediately if it's not immediately.
Right, but I'm saying he's a pretty damn good middle of the diamond prospect. You know, the Rangers go out and break the bank, spending basically $10 million in a day, getting Nomar Mazara, who some considered the best power hitter to come out of Latin America in a long time. You know, a lot of scouts put 80 on the future power. Huge kid, long way away. Obviously, he's 16. Ronald Guzman, who, you know, a lot of people consider the best well-rounded skill set in the Latin American market. You know, signed him for $3.5 million or whatever. Mazara got close to $5 million. They pick up Yohandre Mendez, who was, you know, considered the top lefty in Venezuela. I mean, they spent a lot of fucking money.
They went kind
of
crazy this summer.
They went crazy, but I mean, shit. This is where you find superstars, and with some under the radar guys. I know statistically speaking, David Perez didn't have the best year, but he still missed a bat an inning in the Northwest League as an 18-year-old.
Way more than that. He struck out 43 and 30 in a third innings.
Right. I mean, he's got bat missing stuff. Luke Jackson is a hell of a pitcher from last year. last year's draft. You know, Jorge Alfaro is a hell of a talent. More people are going to start to know who he is. Cody Buchel is a really interesting arm. I mean, they have a lot of players that may not have the same sort of star power that the Jays had, that the Royals had last year, that the Rays had last year. But on paper, like the Jays, there may be more talent in this system than any other system.
And I do think also, like the Jays, however, if you're hoping for things that are going to help in 2012, you might be shit out of luck.
And see, that's the thing, and that could hurt them because it's not as balanced. You have a guy like Martin Perez, Mike Olt, Jerickson Profar, but these guys, I mean, Martin Perez can contribute some next year, but you can't count on a ton. Olt could be a trade chip, or he could move to left field or something. Profar is still a few years away. But this system is just packed with talent. Now, this is talent that is going to go up and it's going to go down.
And either way is going to take a while.
Yeah, and it's going to take a long time. The Rangers have been extremely active, more so than any other team in the Latin American market in the last few years, getting guys like, you know, Luis Marte, who is going to be a hell of a fucking shortstop. I got a Hanley Ramirez comp on him. You know, Odor, Hanser Alberto, David Perez, all the guys they got this year, the legend. I mean, these are guys that, shit, they can take a huge step back, but if they take a step forward, this is a system that can go from top 10 to top 2 quickly. I have them in the top 5 just based on talent.
Okay. Well, speaking of great systems, we have the Tampa Bay Rays.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a very good system. I don't know if it's a great system.
I was about to say, I'm not sure it's great anymore, folks. And I'll tell you why, because, Rays fans are going to hate me after I say this. Not the Rays aren't picking towards the top of the draft every year. Their drafts are suddenly not so darn good. I mean, I know that they had 8 million picks this year, and then people got, oh, the Rays, the super smart Rays with all these picks, they're going to clean up. And they didn't. They had a lot of good picks, but I don't know if they cleaned up. They had a lot of picks in 2010 as well. And go back and look how those guys are doing.
Not so sure about that. I mean, some of those guys just, I don't know if they're players. I've had bad reports on a lot of
them. Yeah,
I
mean,
guys.
You look at that Princeton team and, you know, Josh Sally did nothing. And he has to do something because that's a bat-only kind of player tools-wise. There were all sorts of questions all along about Justin O'Connor's bat. No one, I mean, Justin O'Connor,
he can throw.
That guy's got a huge arm and huge raw power. And he hit 9 home runs and 178 at-bats for Princeton in the Appy League. He looked great defensively, and he hit 157 with 78 strikeouts in those 178 at-bats. And
that's too many, right?
I'm not a stat guy, but that's a high rate. And I had so many scouts just tell me, yeah, he's great behind the plate, he's got power, but he can't hit a lick, and he's never going to. He's so far behind the curve offensively, it's not even funny. He just can't hit. And, you know, that was a fear for people on him coming out of the draft. It was just, you know, boy, he sure is great in Indiana. I've seen him turn on many a 65-mile-an-hour fastball. But he just so little exposure to good pitching, and there were so many questions about him being able to catch up to true fastballs, and he can't. It's just he is such a bad hitter. I don't know if it's going to matter how good an athlete he is and what kind of tools he has. So, look, their drafts look awfully good when they pick first overall. And they had some great picks beyond those great the really early picks. They had, you know, they got Matt Moore and guys like Wade Davis, Desmond Jennings. But their last few drafts, I think, have not looked good at all. And there's no guarantee this 2011 one's going to be anything special either.
I mean, yeah, not yet. Obviously, you have to look at, you know, the developmental process and say, well, they've acquired guys with talent. Let's see how the maturation process works. I mean, look at a guy like Beckham, who's finally starting to put some of those tools to the
field. Really one of the better stories of the year this year.
Sure. And so I can see that the system taking a hit as far as, like, you know, national recognition goes this year, falling out of the top 5. But on paper, they still have a shitload of talent. Obviously, you know, we'll have to see how this draft pans out in a few years and give guys like you know, Connor time to develop, but I mean, the reports on him don't
they're horrible. And I mean, they had some good stories. You talked about Tim Beckham, who showed some signs of life, got to AAA, continued to show some signs of life, and looked better at shortstop as well, which is both encouraging and rare to see a player make that kind of advancement defensively at a shortstop. Speaking of shortstops, Hawk Julie had a great year. It certainly moved up in a lot of people's minds. And you know, I just want to throw this guy out there just because I like talking about him, and that's Matt Bush. Matt Bush, of course, trying to remake himself as a reliever, spent most of the year, or almost the entire year, in the bullpen as a late-inning reliever at AA Montgomery. Matt Bush struck out 77 guys in 50 innings and got into the upper 90s with his fastball and showed a pretty good slider. There's some refinement still in the command. I think Matt Bush is going to get to the big leagues, and I think it's going to be a great story when he does.
Yeah, I mean, since they closed McDuffie's in Peoria, his career's been looking up.
And you know what? Matt Bush maybe has grown up a little bit, too. I did hear some things about how Bush was kind of – even if he wasn't talking to the guy, Bush was almost kind of like an omnipresent – a presence, if you will, in the Montgomery clubhouse as a warning to Tim Beckham. This is what happens.
That's
when stuff doesn't work out. Moving on to the Seattle Mariners, Jason. We've gone through three really great organizations and a really promising one, and now we have to move to the Mariners.
I think that the Mariners have a really good system. I think
the Mariners have a much better system, but I don't know if it's really good yet.
I think it's bottom heavy, and I think that because it's bottom heavy, you can look at it with a skeptical eye. But they have a lot of
talent. Here's the thing. I mean, the Mariners also lost Dustin Ackley and Michael Pineda, just in the sense that they graduated. So that's the top of their prospect list is gone for all the right reasons.
Well, the top tier guys Walker could develop into that. I think he has the potential to. I think that he's still really young.
I think.
He's going to hit some rough
passes. He is potentially a monster. He is. He's hit a rough passage already. He's learning on the job, really. Sure.
So is Pimentel. I mean, that guy's got monster potential, too. I mean, he's a monster.
He's a huge kid, huge power. He had 11 home runs in the Appy League, slowed down toward the end of the year, and has some approach issues, but massive ceiling. Well, let's get back to the pitching, because I think that was really the story in a lot of ways. And one was kind of the explosion of Taijuan Walker, who I think had the most potential of any pitcher in the Midwest League, and that includes Carlos Martinez of the Cardinals.
I think
Martinez is a closer. I don't see any way that guy starts.
I'm really impressed with Martinez.
I understand he throws hard. I just don't see how he starts.
He throws hard with some wiggle.
A lot of wiggle on it, but it's great. He's got a breaking ball. He's also he's not even small. He's also tiny,
he's got a little frame. I mean, he's not a big guy.
It's not easy.
No,
That's not. That's not going to start. He's not going to start long term. Walker's going to start. Walker's great body, ultra athletic, very smooth. Going to start, but the more as pleasant a surprise as Walker was, well, we all thought Walker had tons of potential, and he just showed it. James Paxton was kind of the more pleasant surprise. It was a guy who pitched very well as Walker's teammate. We talked about him over the summer when he pitched in the Midwest League All-Star Game and had the best stuff of anyone in the All-Star Game. And then toward the end of the year, he made 7 starts at AA and killed it. ERA of 1.85, 51 strikeouts in 39 innings. And he is another guy who is a rare power left-hander. Big, big body, big frame kid, about 6'4", 225, up to the mid-90s. Killer breaking ball, just a nasty, nasty,
slurvy,
mean breaking ball. And I thought he looked great. And this is a guy who I would not be shocked if he got to the big league sometime next year.
Yeah, I said that in my minor league awards piece that I submitted to editing. It's probably, I don't know if it's up now, who knows. But I said that I actually thought that he was one of the more intriguing stories of the year, because this is a guy that, his bonus demands, didn't sign with Toronto, didn't get to go back to Kentucky, had to pitch for the Grand Prairie Air Hogs and independent ball, and only had 4 starts and didn't look so hot, and fell to the 4th round, and he held out until spring. And this is a guy that's like, all right, enough already. Are we gonna do this? Do you want to pitch professional baseball? And then he came in and he fucking killed it. You know, made it up to Double A, killed it in Double A. He's got nasty stuff. We've all seen him. His delivery is very long.
Yes.
It is very, very fluid, though. And once his arm gets moving, it takes some time, but once it gets moving, it's very fast. He generates movement on the fastball. It's a plus to plus plus fastball that his changeup will actually fade away. It's not a bad pitch at all. The curveball is like this yucky fucking slurve that, I mean, good
really
luck.
Really vicious pitch.
You know, and it disappears out of his hand because of his delivery. I think he's a hell of a pitcher, and I think he's one of the best stories of the year, just because there was so much buildup, and then, you know, he shows up, and the money shot is there.
Yeah,
know?
And one other guy who kind of came, I don't want to say out of nowhere, this is a guy who had a huge year last year, but it was at High Desert, and no one really bought it, was Kyle Seager, who, you know, smoked it at Double and Triple A and got to the big leagues, where he's been okay. I think he's going to have a career. I don't think it's going to be a great one. But the fact that he can play second and third and maybe even a little tiny bit of short in a pinch and can just lace line drives all over the place, I think he's going to last for quite a while in the big leagues. Never be a star, but at least have a career.
Right. And, I mean, and they have some talent. I mean, I said they're pretty – I think that they're bottom heavy. You know, I had a chance to spend some time around their AZL team, and I was just really impressed with guys like Paguero and Phillips Castillo. I think he's a hell of a fucking player in the making. Got to see Alfredo Morales a little bit at the time. Playing at a lower level, but I think he's a pretty interesting guy. And then, you know, look, they surprised everybody with who they selected in the Rule 4.
With Hudson, yeah.
We talked about it at the time. I mean, that really fucked everybody up from
the
jump. That
screwed up the whole draft. Yeah, congratulations, guys.
But see, it's a good
pick.
Bring into the system.
I think he certainly. I know everyone had them on Rendon, but you know, Hudson, I think, has just as much assuredly to be a guy who can make the impact in the big leagues, and he's a hitter, and he's a pitcher rather instead of a hitter.
Right. I mean, I don't think this is a top tier system, but I think it has a lot of talent, and they should. I mean, I know it's bottom heavy, but if some of those guys continue to take a step forward, like Phillips Castillo, that guy's a fucking hell of a
player.
Yeah,
I mean, there's potential here.
Pimentel? Shit. I mean, that guy. I mean, what happens if he hits? What is it? Juan Gonzalez?
Yeah, absolutely, that's exactly what he is.
Is that the comp you got? That's ridiculous. Juan Gonzalez was ridiculous. He was juiced up, but he was really good.
Well, that went well, Jason.
How long did it take? Did we?
I don't know.
Follow your
rules. I don't
rules?
Know. I forgot to turn on the clock.
Good. Well, that's a fun little exercise.
I like that. It's a fun exercise. So next week, as we continue to work backwards, we'll do the Giants, the Padres, the Cardinals, the Pirates, and the Phillies.
Great. A lot of most of those systems, I'm going to say the exact same thing. Man, there's a lot of talent in this system.
Jason gets excited, folks. And we'll let Jason calm down a bit. We'll come back with Peter Abraham of the Boston Globe to talk about what the hell's going on in Boston right now. And then we'll do the goofy stuff. So stick around, folks. I keep saying folks, Jason. What is that?
Yeah, have you ever said it before? I say it.
And welcome back to the podcast. It's special guest time. Our next guest is the definition of East Coast bias when it comes to beat writers. He's been a beat writer for the Mets. He's been a beat writer for the Yankees. And he's currently is the Red Sox beat writer for the Boston Globe. And he's fantastic on Twitter at Pete Abe. It's joining us from his palatial estate, Peter Abraham. Peter, how are you?
Hey, guys. How are you?
We're doing good. Well, let's face this. How is the city of Boston right now on Tuesday morning with it two games, with the massive lead down to two games?
Well, it's they're very happy that the Patriots are 2-0 and Tom Brady is healthy. That's been everybody's pretty pleased about that, because the Red Sox have given them pretty much nothing but nothing but angst here for about the last 2 weeks. It's been a real bad time for the Red Sox, and this is a city kind of predisposed to panic, and the panic is out there. You know, people are a lot of predictions of doom and gloom, and things, you know, need to be changed, and people need to be fired, and all this other stuff. And it's Yeah, right now the fan base is not real happy.
You said like people need to be fired. Who are they angry at? Because it certainly just seems to me like this is the best team on paper, but that team isn't able to take the field right now.
Yeah, reason is not something in deep supply right now in Boston. I mean, people are just they're angry at Terry Francona, they're angry at Theo Epstein. I think one thing they're maybe understandably angry about is the lack of starting depth in the organization, and that, you know, they're to a point now in these critical games where they're running, you know, Kyle Weiland out there to start games, and he, you know, it was supposed to be up here as kind of a September call-up, you know, getting a chance to look around and getting ready for next year, and here he is starting critical games for them, and that's not something that anybody anticipated. And, you know, you, obviously it's hard to predict that, you know, Clay Buchholz would be out, and Daisuke Matsuzaka would be out, and, you know, John Lackey would be so terrible. But they, you know, it is a little bit surprising, and I agree with the sentiment to some degree that their minor league organization just hasn't been able to give them anybody who can come up and give them a, you know, a representative start, you know, even 5 innings. It's been kind of, you know, for all the money that they sink into the draft, they really haven't had anything come out of it, you know, in the last couple of years in terms of starters.
Yeah, on Twitter, you seem to kind of try to be the reason, voice of reason, and tell people to calm down and not necessarily overreact to things. I mean, are people, how will this turn out if it turns out bad? Will people lose their jobs, or will kind of cooler heads prevail and realize that this is just about the biggest run of bad luck you've ever seen at the end of a year?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, John Henry has proven as an owner to be a pretty reasonable guy. The only times he's really fired people were when he first got there, and he got rid of the people who were there before he took over, and then installed Theo Epstein and Terry Francona, and kind of the rest is history. He doesn't strike me as a guy who is, you know, let's tear it all down and start over again. That's not the way he conducts business. And he is a guy, I think, who is generally unaffected by public sentiment. He's not somebody who's going to listen to the, you know, talk radio shows and be like, okay, well, everybody wants Terry Francona fired, so I'll go out and fire Terry Francona. And I would like to think that Francona and Epstein have built up a pretty good body of work here, you know, certainly together, and there's no reason to get that carried away with it. Among the fans, you know, it's a pretty demanding fan base in terms of baseball, and I think a lot of it is probably the media's fault, you know, for kind of perpetrating this whole, you know, they're going to be the greatest team ever, and the only question is whether they're going to win 100 games, and I think kind of underselling how good the rest of the American League East was going to be this year, particularly the Rays. And I never really bought into the idea that they were going to win 100 games, but a lot of people did. And when, you know, now not only are they not going to win 100 games, you know, they're struggling to get to 90 wins as the season's, you know, coming to an end here. And the fact that they're, you know, struggling to hold on to a wild card spot is way below what people expected. And I think there's a lot of, I don't know if anger is the right word, disappointment, but that, you know, people can't understand how it'll get to this point.
As a beat writer, you know, your job is to be an objective journalist in this situation. But, you know, even though you are writing for the Globe and you are the Red Sox beat writer, is there part of you that roots for losses at times, just in the sense that drama is a great story? Is there part of you that wants a game 163?
Well, yeah. I mean, I worked in New York for 10 years. You know, bad times are always more interesting to write about than good times. It's, you know, we sold a lot more papers and got a lot more website hits in New York when things were going bad than we did when they were going good, that's for sure. I mean, I'm not going to sit around and tell you I'm rooting for them not to do well. But it is more interesting to cover important games in September than it is to cover, you know, let's have the star pitch 4 innings and get him ready for his first playoff start type of games. Kind of what the Yankees are doing right now. But it's, you know, I mean, selfishly, I would like to cover a team in the playoffs. It's much more interesting. It's good for our paper. It's good for our website. You know, one way or another, I'm going to be covering a playoff game. But, you know, you'd like to see what they could do once they got to the playoffs, because I think they actually have a chance to be pretty good. You know, if they can run Josh Beckett and John Lester out there, you know, in a short series, that certainly gives them an advantage over having to use a 5-man rotation. And I think their bullpen is got a chance to be okay. And obviously their lineup is very strong. And I don't see anybody in the American League that's so overwhelming where you say, well, the Red Sox couldn't possibly beat this team. I mean, they've kind of owned the Yankees this year. You know, they'd be very happy not to have Tampa Bay in the playoffs, that's for sure. So I think once they get there, they actually probably could do okay.
In watching the first game of the doubleheader on Monday, the tension was palpable from the fans. I mean, it was a quiet, intense crowd. There's clearly a lot of worry there. Is that carried over into the clubhouse? I mean, is there a tense clubhouse right now as well?
Yeah, there is. It's only been in the last few days. I think they've come to realize that they actually could blow this thing. At first, it was, hey, look at that. It's kind of unusual that we're losing a few games here. And well, you know, that's okay. Kevin Youkilis will be back, and the lineup will be fine. And now it's kind of obvious that if Kevin does come back, it might only be on a very limited basis. It's become obvious that the bullpen has really have some issues now with, you know, beyond Jonathan Papelbon. And Daniel Bard seems to have straightened himself out recently. But, you know, beyond that, they don't really have anybody they can rely on. And I think if you're a guy like David Ortiz or Adrian Gonzalez, then you're looking up. And, you know, the rotation on a given couple days is Kyle Wyland, John Lackey, and Tim Wakefield. You're sort of realizing, well, we've got to score 8 or 9 runs here to win this game. And that's, you know, even for a very good offense, that's a lot to ask, you know, to score that many runs night after night. And they haven't been able to do it, obviously. And I think it's come a point now where, you know, they walked in when they got home from the last road trip, and there were, I think, 7 or 8 television cameras in the clubhouse, which is probably about 5 more than usual. And they were all there to kind of, you know, record the panic and record the collapse. And I think that was sort of the indicator to the players that, you know, this is more than just it's a couple days and we'll be fine and, you know, see you in October. And that sense has really started to kind of permeate the clubhouse, I think.
You talked about how the Boston fan base might not at times be the most rational. And I think that applies even when things are going well. You know, it's always fun to follow you during a game and, you know, during a Red Sox-Yankees game, an innocent hit by a pitch turns into we should fight them and throw back at them. Do you find that irrationality carries over into blaming individual players for poor performances right now?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, everybody is, you know, even Adrian Gonzalez, who's had a terrific season, you know, and a season, you know, in most places would be, you know, people would be, you know, talking about how to honor a guy who did something like that. You know, people are nitpicking about Adrian Gonzalez, and they can't understand, you know, why his first half didn't carry over into the second half to the same degree. And you try to explain to people, you know, he hit 50 points over his career batting average in the first half, and that was very unlikely not going to happen in the second half. And, you know, at one point he was on a pace to drive in 165 runs, and you try to explain to people that's, you know, very not going to happen. And they can't understand, well, why not? And I think people, you know, I think it's hard for, you know, any fan in any city to understand that, you know, over 162 players are pretty much going to get to where they're going to get to. And whether it's a real bad streak or a real good streak, those don't continue. But when you see a guy going great, you just, you know, I think fans here think, well, then he's just going to keep doing that. And it's hard for them maybe to understand, you know, why that hasn't happened. So now they're nitpicking on his numbers against the Yankees and his numbers against the Rays. And, you know, you try to say this is a guy in a new league and, you know, there's going to be some adjustments and there's going to be some ups and downs. And over the course of the entire season, he's going to have a tremendous season. But, you know, they're kind of looking at it more, well, why didn't he get 3 hits yesterday?
And on the other side, the other new face or another new face is Carl Crawford, who's had beyond a disappointing season. But with so many other kind of stories, with John Lackey always being bad, with Dice K being out, and with the team as a whole kind of scuffling for a playoff spot, is Carl Crawford's, you know, really bad year in a first year of a really big contract, is he kind of lucking out in that he's getting overshadowed by some of the other problems going on right now?
Well, a little bit, but that's you know, starting to not be the case. I think people are, you know, looking at Crawford and really seeing now that, you know, we're pretty much at the end of 162 and you know, he's not going to have anything resembling a good season. You know, this isn't back in June when everybody was thinking, well, he's, you know, it'll click in and he'll get back to doing what he does, and that's never happened. And I think the dynamic with Crawford is a little bit more unusual in that he always played well against the Red Sox when he was with the Rays. He tortured the Red Sox. He'd steal 4 bases. He'd do all of these great things. He'd hit for power. He'd make all of these great catches in left field. And he, you know, if you're a Red Sox fan and your only exposure to Carl Crawford was primarily watching him play against your team, you know, you thought this guy was Willie Mays. I mean, he was great against the Red Sox. And obviously, you know, that hasn't been the case playing for the Red Sox. And that's been really disappointing, I think, to people, because they were expecting probably more than he was capable of, and he hasn't even come up anywhere near that. So it's you know, it's been a very odd season for Carl, because, you know, he's such a good player, and I think he represents the kind of player that organizations should try to get at this point in baseball history. You know, he's an athletic guy, a versatile guy, a guy who doesn't rely on power, you know, and he's a good defensive player, and all of the things that he's good at. He just, you know, he hasn't even been good defensively this year. You know, he hasn't been bad, but he hasn't been kind of the, you know, the Carl Crawford best left fielder in baseball kind of guy. And it's just been, it's been hard to watch, and it's been hard for him. He's really, he's taken it very personally.
What are the kind of some of the theories behind his struggles, and which ones do you buy?
Well, he hurt his hamstring in June, and I think when a guy who's a speed player has a leg injury, that's obviously a problem. And I think, you know, the fact that he hasn't hit second like he normally did in Tampa or somewhere in the top of the lineup, that's really affected him too. I think he thinks, you know, that you know, when he was with the Rays, no matter what happened, he was going to hit in the top of the order for the most part, you know, over the last 5 years. Now, that was a lot of primarily because they didn't have anybody better. But the Red Sox have guys who were playing better. So he's hit seventh pretty much, or sixth, almost the entire season. And I think that's hard for him, kind of not being one of the guys who's getting up there to swing in the first inning and not being a guy that everybody's counting on and not being the center of attention. He's not used to that. And that's taken him a long time to adjust to. And he felt like when they did have him at the top of the order, it was at the beginning of the year when they had that 2-10 start. Right. And at that point, you know, everything was off the boards. You know, they were going to do anything they could to try to straighten the team out at that point. And one of the things they did was drop him down. And then when they dropped him down, and not because they dropped him down, but, you know, kind of coincidentally, that's when they went on this great run. And Pedroia's in second, Gonzalez is hitting third, Euclid's is hitting fourth, and Ortiz is hitting fifth. And they had this terrific offense, so they weren't going to change things to accommodate Carl Crawford. And he just kind of ended up sixth or seventh. And I think that's kind of played into it a little bit, you know, that he's just not used to being in that position in the order.
There was a little bit of I'm about to say controversy, but after the first game yesterday, I mean, David Ortiz just flat out came and said it, you know, it said, you know, Seiva should be starting instead of Kyle Wieland. With a start somewhere in the run that's going to go to that slot, is it going to be a Seiva or Wieland?
You know, I don't know that it can be a Seves. He hasn't pitched more than three innings since June. And I think it would be hard to ask a guy like, you know, okay, well, now go out there and start. And he's probably got more value to them in the bullpen. You know, I mean, it didn't play out in the first game last night when he threw three shutout innings. But he's been immensely valuable to them in a lot of different roles. He's come in to get one batter. He's come in to throw three innings. He's, you know, he's done a lot of different things. He's effective against lefties and righties alike. And he's, no lineup really intimidates him, and he doesn't even seem to be. There were twice yesterday in that first game when he had guys in scoring position, no outs, and took care of it like it was nothing. And, you know, Francona's kind of reticent to give that up out of the bullpen. And if they were going to make that move to make him a starter, they would have had to have done it, I think, you know, 2.5 weeks ago to just give him a chance to stretch out and give him a chance to get into a regular routine. But now, you know, he pitched three innings yesterday, so you can't have him. Okay, well, now we're going to have you throw a long bullpen and stretch you out a little bit. You know, I think it's too late for that. At this point, you know, he is what he is.
So with seven games left in the season, or eight rather, you know, five of them against Baltimore, one tonight with Rick Vanderhoek on the mound. Is the panic overstated? Is Boston's going to get in the playoffs here, right?
Well, boy, when you watch some of those guys Baltimore was running out there yesterday, you would think so. I mean, you know, the Red Sox offense, even without Euclid's, was really, you know, they probably should have had more runs in the first game against Jeremy Guthrie. They hit him harder than what the final score showed. But it's, yeah, you would think so. I mean, playing all those games against Baltimore, you would have to think is really going to help them. And the Orioles, by the time the Sox get to Camden Yards at the end of the season, you know, those are going to be the last three games of the year for the Orioles. You know, the Sox will be, you know, those will be important games one way or another for the Sox. So that would be an advantage. And you would think the fact that the Rays have to play the Yankees so often, even with the Yankees kind of, you know, in a mode where they're preparing for the playoffs, you know, the Yankees aren't going to lose every game against the Rays. So, yeah, you know, the schedule tells you that the Sox are in pretty good shape. The rotation, you know, is not a good sign. They, you know, their offense should be able to overcome the rotation at this point.
Well, Peter, I want to thank you for joining us. I know you have plenty of exciting games. I hope you won't have another doubleheader like Monday. That game, too, was kind of brutal. And enjoy the rest of the season. We'll keep following you on Twitter.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks for coming on.
All right.
Welcome back to the podcast, Jason. It's time for the goofy stuff.
Righto.
Our musical guest is a return. We have a repeat musical guest. It's Screaming Females, the power punk trio from New Brunswick, New Jersey. It comes to us courtesy of John Giovanni Records. And the reason we're playing this is because, you know, they're all hip and cool and have a lot of indie cred and indie buzz. And so the fine folks at Don Giovanni Record are re-releasing their first two self-published albums on vinyl, of course, because that's what cool people do. And this is from their second album, which is called What If Someone Is Watching Their TV? Screaming Females, Power Punk at its finest, from the good people at Don Giovanni Records, who provide us frequently with music to the podcast. We appreciate that, and I'm wearing my Don Giovanni Records shirt. And till next week, I will promise you this much, we'll have another repeat band. That has a new album out that we played in the past. And Jason just dropped something, and you will like it. And but we do remind you that if you are in a band, if you have a family member in a band, if you know someone in a band, have them get in touch with us, please, at podcast@baseballperspectives.com so we can play their music. Jason Parks, very important question for you.
That was funny.
What are you drinking?
I'm drinking Squirt. I'm drinking Mexican Squirt. Sounds bad. The little Mexican bodega around the... This is funny. I was going over to a friend's house the other day, and I wanted to grab some... because I had a bottle of mezcal that I brought back from Mexico, and I was going to... It's if you're not drinking it straight, it tastes really good with Squirt, which is like the, you know, the 7-Up or Sprite in Mexico. I mean, you find Squirt everywhere. They have Squirt absolutely everywhere, and it goes very well with mezcal. It becomes a nice cocktail, and it goes good with gin as well.
What is it like?
Squirt? It's like grapefruit. It's like a grapefruit soda.
And you mix it with mezcal?
Yeah.
What is that called? Is it called like a squirt skull? Or
I don't know. I don't think it's called that.
A squirt quasicodal?
I don't think it's called that. I don't know if it has a name. It's just, it tastes good. You know, I had several the other night. I lost at FIFA because of that. but the Mexican bodega has them. And so I saw them and I bought them, and that's what I'm drinking tonight. I'm drinking... It's just Squirt. I don't have anything in it. It's just Squirt. I used to drink Squirt when I was a kid.
And it's Mexican Squirt. Did you bring this back with you?
No, I told you. I got it at the bodega.
Are you sure it's Mexican?
Yeah, it says it's made in Mexico.
Is there American Squirt?
I'm sure there is. I haven't seen Squirt in a long time. As I was saying, I mean, I used to drink Squirt when I was a kid back in Texas. I enjoyed Squirt. I like saying it. But I don't see it as much, and I'm not seeking it out. But when I was in Mexico, I got back into drinking Squirt, and I happened to see it in the Mexican bodega, and so I was like, oh, okay, well, I'm gonna have some Squirt. I like it. It's really tasty. I mean, it's absolutely fucking everywhere in Mexico City, so I just, you know, I started drinking it, and I started mixing it with gin and mezcal, like the clear mezcal, and... it's good. It tastes really good. I mean, the cocktails I made the other night, they affected my FIFA play, but they did their job. They were really tasty. Believe it or not, that bodega actually sell that they have Victoria as well. They don't have Victoria six packs. They have like the 32 ounce
Oh, Jesus.
Victorias, because that's I don't know how they get them, but I got those there. I took those over too.
It's important to note, we talked recently about starting a FIFA league. That's not going to happen. We have too much to do, folks.
No, I'm going to be in a FIFA league, but it's just it's going to be with my FIFA posse. I don't trust anybody else.
So we'll have more updates from the FIFA league.
What are you drinking, though?
I have a glass of World Classics Organic Lemonade. So it's the same color as Squirt, but it's not Squirt. Now, what I'm really doing here is denying the end of summer, Jason, because it's look at my computer. It's 58 degrees right now. There's been plenty of days where, you know, it's time to put on the hoodie, and I refuse, and I'm fighting it by drinking lemonade.
I love wearing hoodies.
I'd rather not need one, though.
I was wearing a hoodie earlier. It was my French national team soccer hoodie. It's fucking awesome looking. Don't really care about the team, but the aesthetic is fantastic.
Well, it's French.
Yeah, they're the entire league.
The French understand aesthetics. Come on, they're French.
Well, at the core they do, yes.
I made a cassoulet over the weekend, in case you didn't follow me on Twitter.
I unfollow you during football weekends, and then I follow you again. I just don't want to hear any comments you have about football. So I just block you.
Aside from
how
pop culture,
how did it turn out, though?
It was a very good cassoulet. Some duck.
It takes a lot of work.
It's not that hard.
You got to do a lot of browning.
You got to do a lot of brown. You got to brown your meat, folks. And that's really good advice in all fields.
Sure.
So it's pop culture moment, Jason. I'm going to talk about Moneyball just for a little bit here.
Good. Because you know, it's not. I don't get to hear about it enough.
Here's the thing: no one's talking about Moneyball. There's very little hype around it. Very few people writing articles about Moneyball. Really underpublicized. But that's not what I want to talk about. What I want to talk about is the level of discourse, because I think we're going backwards. I think, you know, when Moneyball first came out, it kind of created some an ugly divide, if you will, between the scouting world and the numbers world.
That's a good way to put it, I think.
And
it was ugly.
And I think it's coming back in a lot of ways. I think we're once again, there's kind of some empowerment here, and where the people can number people can say, hey, the other people are stupid, and the other people can say, hey, the number of people,
hey, it didn't work,
hey, the number of people are a pain in the ass, and we need to all get along, folks. It's the teams that are doing this the best are the teams that are marrying the numbers stuff with the scouting stuff. Teams that just do number stuff don't exist, and when they over focused on it, they did not succeed. People who just do scouting stuff and don't do enough of the number stuff are not succeeding either. You need both. I hate to break your hearts here, folks, but the Oakland A's have a scouting staff.
Yes, they do.
Filled with really, really smart people who talk about things like tools and upside and
scouting
and ceilings and things like that. And the things they say and the things that they write down play an incredibly important part in the Oakland A's decision-making process. And it's important to note that that was the same case in 2002. Everyone needs to get along here, folks. I don't want to see this divide happen again. I don't want to see ugliness. I don't want to see people saying you're stupid about your AL MVP opinion because it's not based on some sort of number. Screw that, folks. All thoughts are welcome as long as it's intelligent and consistent. End of rant.
Fair enough. I'm with you. I'll sign on that.
So what you got going on this week, Jason? You're going on a little trippy trip.
I'm going on a trip. Where am I going? I'm going to the Instructional League in Arizona. I'll be out there for about 8 days, 9 days. I am flying out on Friday. I am going to play FIFA the entire time and hopefully hone some of my skills so that when I return, I can beat people who live in New York, who I have yet to beat.
What about people in Illinois who have never played a FIFA game? Do you hope to beat them as well?
Well, I mean, it's I don't own it, and once I get back, I am going to purchase a system and the game, and I am going to start playing. I'm going to play so often. And I have one goal. Just one.
To score a goal.
To score a goal on Jorge. I've beat other people.
And once that's done, you're just gonna light your PlayStation 3 on fire.
I'm gonna light his on fire and just walk out. going to take my squirt that I brought over and just bolt. Later.
So when you're not playing FIFA in Arizona, you're going to see baseball.
Yeah, I'm going to be going around to the complexes. I'm going to be watching, you know, a lot of practices, a lot of games, advanced games, regular Instructs games. There's just a shitload of talent out there. A lot of the teams that I tend to follow out there have a lot of depth in the lower part of the minors, and that's generally who shows up to the instructional league. Players who are going to see stateside in 2012. And the Rangers, for example, their instructional league roster is stacked with 16 and 17-year-olds who are no doubt going to play stateside ball.
Is there a particular starting pitching prospect in the Rangers organization born in 1995 that you're interested in?
Oh, Healy Arias?
How do you say that first name?
I'm just Healy, I assume.
And how would you like to say it, though?
Jelly? Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of kids born in 94 and 95, and it's kind of creepy. And to
but
know
not,
that,
but not for you.
No, not for me. I'm comfortable. But they're going to be playing stateside ball, and I assume a lot of them will. And you know how the Rangers are. I mean, if there's a 16 or 17-year-old and they have some promise, the Rangers are not afraid to put them in a stateside action.
To play them in the Carolina League.
They will push them. But what's interesting about that is that that presents a really interesting scouting scene. When you get to see advanced 17-year-olds on the field with, you know, slightly advanced 18, 19, and 20-year-olds, you really get to see how special that 17-year-old is.
Yeah, it's always a fun time for me. It's an important time for me as well, just because this is the time you start getting phone calls. Often of guys you don't know or you barely know or maybe have not heard of but only know a little bit about. But I do remember, you know, a couple of years back during Instructs, a scout calling me. During Instructs, you could hear gloves popping and bats hitting balls. And he said, kind of whispering, "Hey, I'm calling from Arizona. What do you know about this Profar guy?" And you're like, oh, he must be getting some buzz. And then like three more people asked the same thing within about 4 days.
Yeah.
And that's how guys get some buzz. That's how you start to learn about some of these new players. And some of these players born in 1994 and 1995.
Instructs is a lot of fun. I mean, there are guys who can have just, you know, fantastic instructs, and they can really light the prospect fire. Then they come out and disappoint. The thing is that this is not like spring training. This is a lot of these guys played full seasons. You know, they even if it's short season, you know, they started off in spring training, went to extended, and went to short season ball. I mean, it's a long year, and this is the end of that year, and it's still fucking hot as shit.
And a lot of them have very specific things to work on.
Right, they're working on specific things, but then every once in a while you see somebody just really stand out, and, you know, quite often that player takes a step forward the next season as well. So it's a great time to scout these guys. It's a hell of a lot of fun. Even though it's hot, but yeah, I'm headed out there on Friday, and I'll be back after the first.
So our next podcast, you will be in Arizona.
I will, and I may not be on it, as it turns out. Maybe I'll be a guest.
We'll figure out what the internet connection is out there, and we'll go from there.
I just don't know about the time. I don't know if I'm going to have time.
You'll make time.
I don't think so. I'll make time to be a guest. I got FIFA to play.
Oh, okay.
What do you have?
I don't know what I have. I also
have an article coming out.
You do have an article coming out on the top 10 pitchers. What's specific about these pitchers, Jason?
It's just my minor league awards for the pitcher side, but I rank like the top 10 Texans who are pitching. I rank the disappointing guys. I rank the best fastball, the best changeup, the best curve, the best slider.
Do you want to go over this now since you're not going to be around again? Let's do this.
We can do it next week.
Well, you said you're not going to be around next week. The article will be
I can be a guest. I can be a guest.
Not doing that. Not doing that one darn bit.
I can't be a guest on the show?
Nope. You're either a co-host or you're not. I'm not demoting you.
I bet I can talk about what I'm seeing in Instructs. It can be a segment. Jason and Instructs.
I don't like this. Jason should be on the whole show.
Jason doesn't have 3 hours to spend next week, I don't think.
Yes, he does.
I don't think so. I think I'm going to call in soon.
So if you follow us on Twitter, yell at Jason, Professor Parks, about doing the show next week. And we'll go from there.
So what do you have?
I finished that piece that we talked about last week about Moneyball. You saw it. I sent you a copy of it.
It's actually very good.
Thank you. And
what did I tell you?
You'll see that you said it was so good you didn't think I wrote it.
What a dick thing to say.
And
it was really good, though.
You'll see that I found out on Friday at ESPN. They have kind of like a big money ball package going up at ESPN.com. You'll see it on Friday. And again, what I did was there's 8 million people talking, writing about Moneyball. And I wanted to take a unique approach towards it. And, you know, I make no secrets of the fact that, you know, due to assignments I've had in the past, other things, I've gotten to know a lot of people in the Oakland front office fairly well. And so I was able to talk to Billy Beane, a couple of former podcast guests, and David Forrest and Keith Lippman, as well as the scouting director, Eric Kubota, about not Moneyball, but the Oakland A's today and how things have changed. In how they draft, how they identify players to acquire, and how they develop them, et cetera, since the days of Moneyball. And it was a fun piece to do, and I thought it turned out very well. And
excellent.
So, and so that's up, and then I'm also working on some book stuff.
Yes.
And that's about it. And I've also actually done some pre-work for Top 11 time, which, of course, the Top 11 prospect lists will start after the World Series. And I think they've already clinched our first top 11 will be the Houston Astros.
Yikes. Evando's good.
So he is good. And so we'll be doing the Houston Astros list first. And just like last year, we started doing this. I started doing it this way last year. This will be in draft order. And, you know, currently the Astros have a 7-game or 6.5-game lead over the Twins.
They have it.
So they pretty much have it. So right now it's looking very much like the first three. Will be the Astros, the Twins, and then either the Orioles or the Mariners. And then we'll, and of course we'll do all 30, and just like last year, we'll talk about them as they come out.
Excellent.
So Jason, it's time for the saddest part of the show. It's when you say goodbye to the internet.
Goodbye.
And we'll talk to you next week with five more teams of prospects, special guests, and who knows what else. And maybe Jason will be here, and maybe he won't, because he does no want. Thanks for listening, everyone.